I'm really happy to have your company and be with you today. I'm giving this talk in the middle of December 2020. And 2020 has not been an easy year. And I think that all of us are just longing for it to be over and looking forward to next year, hoping that it will bring some better things to ourselves and the universe. December is rich with pivotal days that mark endings and refreshing new beginnings. We just celebrated Buddha's Enlightenment Day, Rohatsu, on December 8th. We're looking forward to the winter solstice when the light returns, or starts to return, at least for us in the Northern Hemisphere. And this year we have this brilliant conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn happening on the same day, which somehow feels significant. And then finally we have New Year's Eve. The people at Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people, they selected the word pandemic for 2020 as the word of the year. And that makes sense, but I have been thinking that the word could have been or should have been pivot. A pivot is a central point on which a mechanism turns. To pivot implies changing direction in an immediate way rather than gradually. Once the pandemic started, the word pivot seemed to appear every day in news reports on how people were suddenly learning and jumping into new ways of doing things. Even today, it's on the news, reporting on the FDA approval of a vaccine for COVID and also on a Supreme Court decision about the election. There's been a lot of pivoting this year. Some people are doing okay with it, but many are not. Many people, many families have lost people. And for everyone, having to constantly figure things out, finding new ways of doing things, even ways to survive, it's been exhausting. So I think we need to find a way to tap into the energy at the spiritual pivot. At the spiritual pivot, there is a place where energy flows into us and into the universe. And for me, that is something that is important to keep in mind. Katagiri Roshi had a name for this spiritual pivot. He called it the pivot of nothingness. He was talking about the moment when the life force energy of the universe turns in its direction from emptiness toward the creation of form. I think of this whenever I hear the word pivot. So today I want to say something about this spiritual pivot. I'm speaking for myself here. And I'm offering you my take on some ideas from Buddhism. And I can't promise that if I were to talk about this another day, I would say the exact same thing. It's just what I'm thinking about right now. I think it's a real weirdness of Buddhism that emptiness, which is a beautiful teaching and a liberating awareness to experience, is represented by words that feel so dangerous. Words like nothingness, no self, or the void. They feel ominous somehow. Maybe because they threaten our usual egocentric point of view, which doesn't like the idea of not being relevant. In Buddhist philosophy, the Sanskrit word shunyata represents awareness of the emptiness or voidness or nothingness that constitutes ultimate reality. But shunyata is not a negation of existence. It represents the vast ground from which everything takes form. It is an affirmation of the potentiality of the whole universe. A Buddhist dictionary says it is this: the fertile undifferentiation out of which all apparent entities, distinctions, and dualities arise. That's the fertile undifferentiation out of which all apparent entities, distinctions, and dualities arise. I think that to understand the Buddhist idea of emptiness, it's really important to keep this fertile, creative function in mind. Sometimes I think it would have been better to keep the original word shunyata as the ground of being that gives rise to the material world and not translate it into words like emptiness, nothingness, or voidness. It seems to me that these words may resonate differently in our Western minds than the way they did in the minds of our Eastern ancestors. Influenced as they were by the Taoist philosophy that was part of their long-standing culture, our Zen ancestors in China would have recognized words like nothingness and emptiness as yin, the dark, fertile absence that gives birth to yang, the bright presence of the 10,000 things, which are a way of speaking of the world of material form. And that world bursts forth from the absence of yin from moment to moment. In a Chinese landscape painting, the white areas representing sky, clouds, or water represent emptiness or absence as the original ground, the underlying reality, or the generative source from which the ink-drawn characters of trees, rocks, or mountains are emerging. Those things are visible temporarily as they understand it, and then return back to the source. In China, they looked at paintings like this as a form of meditation, trying to imagine themselves within this dynamic universe that was unfolding. In the Zazen meditation that we do, we might settle into the depth of our lives and realize our original nature as this yin, dark, still, quiet, empty ground, and become open, aware, receptive to the creative life energy that is living there and living through us and will give form and shape to our life from moment to moment. According to my understanding of the Buddhist cosmology that Katagiri Roshi taught, the universe is being created and recreated anew from moment to moment. There is no God, no agent, or force outside the system. Life generates and uses its own energy. Normally, this is beyond our human perception, although it sometimes does reveal itself to us visually or experientially. Maybe you could say that emptiness is like a womb in which life is pregnant with itself, gives birth to itself, lives for a moment as the material world, then returns to the vastness of the womb and impregnates itself for the birth of the next moment, If we try to understand emptiness as a standalone concept, it's easy to feel confused because emptiness only makes sense when we see it as part of a system. I did some thinking about this while I was drinking tea. For a teacup, while its beauty is a value that it has, it's the empty space within its shape that is essential to its identity. Without it, a teacup does not exist as a teacup. That emptiness is the cup's capacity or potential for something to happen. It can hold tea. But the cup's capacity to hold tea is useless on its own. It depends on certain conditions. Someone to prepare the tea, some tea leaves to have grown and been acquired, hot water heated on a stove or fire, maybe a serving tray, or the arrival of a guest. When all the conditions are arranged and cooperating harmoniously in the proper moment of time, people can enjoy drinking tea. Life is like this. The emptiness of the teacup allows the form of the teacup to function. And the functioning gives meaning to the teacup's life. And it's the same with us. Emptiness is the sublime capacity our human life has to function in a way that assures us that our life is worthwhile. When Katagiri taught the pivot of nothingness, he connected the generative source with cause and effect and with time. He talked about how it all works together as a system to create the universe as a new and magnificent event occurring in every moment of time. I think of the pivot as what occurs at the mysterious moment when we with either in and everything in emptiness as one formless being. And then the generative energy of life starts to move. It's moving from emptiness toward form. At that pivot of nothingness, suddenly everything bursts forth as the countless individual forms, beings, and happenings of the material world, including us. Unfortunately, even though we are still interconnected as one universal being, our ego consciousness hides it from our awareness, and we forget and start discriminating one thing from another. This is the fundamental human ignorance. From that basis, our afflictive desires start to appear. If I think of Katagiri's nothingness as no-thingness, I find it easier to imagine the original vastness where everything exists together with no lines of separation. This cosmic vastness or emptiness is what we call in Buddhism our original nature or our ground of being. It is sometimes called Buddha, big mind, true self, reality, or universal consciousness. If you encounter it directly, you realize your Buddha nature. For me, remembering that my existence is always coming and returning to this ground of being is a way of calming my mind and body. I try to relax there and push a reset button so that the next moment is fresh and I can allow things to develop in the best possible way. So here's a story. Soon after the stay-at-home orders were put in place in March, a friend of mine posted a little story of feeling gratitude on Facebook. She was preparing for being stuck at home, and she went shopping at her local craft store to get supplies to support her creative hobby while she was stuck at home. But the store was really crowded and there were long lines for service. My friend was feeling very annoyed and grouchy about the whole situation. Maybe resentful that people were getting in her way. But then suddenly something shifted. Point of view experienced something outside of her control, and suddenly her heart was filled with love, appreciation for everything that was going on around her. She saw that all of these other people in the store were just like her. They all loved making things, and the joy of making would support them throughout the pandemic. She felt like celebrating. So what happened? I think she had a taste of her inborn Buddha nature. My friend is a Zen meditator. I think she just instinctively stopped paying attention to her grouchy thoughts, as we train ourselves to do. Zazen is a practice of renewal, being willing to let go of our thoughts, our afflictive feelings, and start fresh from any moment. For an instant, she was free of that self-centered mind, that concept-forming process that clouds our view of life with ideas of good and bad, right and wrong. She was momentarily, instantaneously present in the original ground of being, where she was part of everything. Then from that place, she emerged back into her everyday life as a slightly changed person, filled with feelings of universal love and belonging, belonging to something bigger than herself. She herself was not aware of what had happened. She was only aware of the peace and happiness that she suddenly felt. Katagiri Roshi had a visual image for conveying the idea of form emerging from somethingness. Emerging from nothingness into somethingness. He talked about the kind of sculpture that is called relief. A relief sculpture is a complex three-dimensional carving where the figures emerge and protrude from a solid background that is retained so it can be mounted on a stone wall. In this art form, there is a sense of somethingness emerging from a nothingness, which yet continues to be present. It has a dynamic feeling to it, as opposed to a standalone sculpture. Of course, there are limits to this metaphor, because the sculpture cannot then dissolve back into its source, stone. and reappear a moment later. But anyway, before the carving, emptiness was in a sense visible as a blank piece of stone. And form was on the inside, invisible, but existing as a potential for shape or form to exist. During the carving, form became visible as figures, and then emptiness became invisible on the inside as the original nature of the stone. I've been thinking of this process as a kind of turning inside out. In the beginning, form is within emptiness as formless potential. Then at the pivot of nothingness, emptiness turns itself inside out. Now, form is visible as individual beings, all of us, and emptiness is within each of us. I've been thinking that perhaps this is why there is a dot of the opposite color inside the rotating waves of the yin-yang symbol that represents Tao, the Buddha way. And perhaps it is even what Avalokiteshvara is talking about in the Heart Sutra when he says that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. That's a hard one, and I'm still thinking about that one. But I think if we can understand that the original vastness of life, called Buddha, has turned itself inside out and is existing within our human forms right now, we have a way of making sense of what it means to say, we are Buddha, or we have Buddha nature, or as Dogen would prefer to say it, we are Buddha nature. Either way, I look at that emptiness inside us as the jewel of Buddha that is waiting for us to discover. One way we can use the pivot intentionally is to turn from being self-centered to having a broader point of view. And by doing that, we can expand our sense of who we are. I had a little pandemic moment when I was walking on a path in my neighborhood. I came upon a group of four people who were chatting with each other and ambling along the path. They were taking up the whole path. Immediately, I'm irritated and I'm thinking, what is wrong with these people? Don't they know the pandemic rule of walking single file, trying to create social distancing space for other people? Now I'm stuck behind them. But then my mind immediately turned and I thought, well, maybe they're not from around here. So I spoke up very cheerfully and I said, say, folks, would you mind if I passed you? And they responded so positively. They immediately moved over. They were friendly with me. And in a brief moment, they chatted and smiled and we kind of joked with each other. And I moved on from that with this feeling of having shared an unexpected moment of intimacy. And I felt good about it. For a long time, it stayed with me. These are the kind of everyday pivots that are available when we intentionally move our point of view away from ourselves and see things in a bigger way. It seems kind of simple and ordinary, but we have to train ourselves to behave that way. Sitting Zazen conditions our mind to become aware of our thoughts and form the habit of not believing everything that we think or not staying with everything that we think. It teaches us to remember how interconnected we really are and to wait for new possibilities to arise before choosing what to do. Here's an example of an organization intentionally turning toward a bigger point of view. Last year, World Vision, a humanitarian aid organization that runs child sponsorship programs to benefit poor areas of the world, came up with a new program that was a big change to the way they had always done things. Usually, the old way, a would-be sponsor chooses a child from something like a catalog of available children and makes a commitment to support that child with a monthly payment. But the new program came up with a twist. They turned things around. The program took photos of the would-be sponsors and then carried the photos to Bangladesh. There, they set up a display of all the potential sponsors' photos and let the children choose their sponsor. The sponsors then got back a photo of their child holding there the sponsor's photo and smiling happily. And they heard what the child who chose them said about why they had made that decision. It was a way of putting dignity and the power of choice in the children's hands and letting them know that just because they had less did not mean that they were less. And the sponsors felt appreciated in a deeper way because they had been seen and chosen by their child. Relationships formed and everyone's life grew bigger. They saw the humanity in each other. And their only question after that was, why haven't we always done it this way? So we're about to pivot to a new year. On New Year's Eve, Zen temples and monasteries, well, in Japan at least, and I don't know if this is how widespread this is actually, but in Japan, there is the custom of saying goodbye to the old year and welcoming in the new year by ringing 107 bells at midnight, as midnight approaches, and then one final 108th. At midnight. It was done here at Zen Center during Katagiri Roshi's time, and it was a very moving experience. That huge bell that is now down at Hokioji was placed right in the middle of the altar, and we all took turns walking up to it and giving it an emphatic strike. When I think of it now, I wonder how the Doan kept count and how they got the timing right so that all ended at the right stroke of midnight. And I always had the question, why is it 108? So I found out by Googling that the 108 desires, the 108 represents the desires that have trapped us in suffering in the year that is ending. And by striking the bell, we are saying farewell to them and stating our intention to be free of them in the coming year. That's a big hope. 108 is an auspicious number in Eastern spirituality. There are various ways that the number is arrived at mathematically, which are kind of interesting, but not worth talking about right now. It's of interest to note there are 108 beads in the beaded mala that some Buddhist priests wear wrapped around their wrists. In yoga, there are 108 energy lines, and they converge at the heart chakra. It also happens that the diameter of the sun is 108 times that of the earth. And an official baseball has 108 stitches. According to Vedic cosmology, the number 108 is the basis of creation and represents our universe. Lord Shiva is the cosmic dancer whose dance of creation and destruction has 108 poses. This cosmic dancing reminds me of the line in T.S. Eliot's famous poem, Burnt Norton, which appears in the first of his famous four quartets. He said, "At the still point in a turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point there the dance is. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance." I want to end with something from David White. He's a contemporary poet who calls himself an instinctive Irish Catholic Buddhist. White tells of a conversation he had with the Austrian Benedictine monk, Brother David Steindl-Rast. When White asked Brother David to help him understand the exhaustion he was feeling around his work at a nonprofit, Brother David said, "You know, the antidote to exhaustion is not necessarily rest. The antidote to exhaustion is wholeheartedness. The reason you are so stressed is that you have lost the conversation at the center of your life. You've lost the pivot point, and you've lost your piece of the ground. You must get back onto that ground, and you must begin the conversation. That's what will take you into the life that you want. After a while, you don't actually want to keep your old static identity. You want to move the pivot of your presence away from this thing you think is you into self-forgetfulness. That is where you meet something other than yourself, and all kinds of astonishing things happen." I am really hoping that we can find, that I can find this wholeheartedness to live in the circumstances, whatever the new year brings. My hope for the new year is that humanity as a whole will grow weary of feeling mean, angry, and fearful, and pivot toward mutual respect, dignity, and understanding, and that we can engage in grounded conversation about things that matter with all people. The healer Carolyn Meese said, "In my soul, I can comprehend the fluidness of creation and how rapidly humanity can collectively shift an outcome. That is our power. That is my reason for optimism." So may this one shared energy arising within each of us nourish our collective life and imbue our words, thoughts, and action with wisdom and compassion. I'm wishing peace and love for all of you in 2021. And always, thank you so much.